Welcome back, Red Ice members. We are talking with Adrian Gilbert. Very interesting conversation here about many different things, Egyptology being one. And we kind of interrupted a little bit just when we were talking about the experience that Adrian was having, or the when he was meeting this clairvoyant lady, who I guess Adrian had some kind of information to reveal or share with you regarding the shafts in the pyramid. Is that right?
That's correct, yes. I mean, I was asked to meet her by her publishers. This was at the time when the Orion mystery was really quite a big story. So they wanted to meet me to talk to her about, she'd received some diagrams that she claimed to have been, I don't know if abducted is the right word, but she, in spirit, could visit flying saucer. Mm-hmm. Sounds a bit bizarre, doesn't it? But she claimed that when she's there, that certain images were kind of imprinted into her mind. And then when she got back, she was able to draw them, what she had seen. And they involved pyramids and stars. So they asked me if I would have a look and see if these made any sense to me, because they didn't make any sense to them or to her.
Right, yeah.
Right. So I said, okay, well, you know, I'm always game to find out. You know, I don't believe that I know everything. I'm always keen to meet people, see what they have to say.
Of course.
So I went along, and she showed me these drawings. And the first one was really quite shocked me, because it was a picture of Ganton Brink's door. I recognized it immediately.
Mm-hmm.
But she had received this drawing on January the 10th, or 8th, sometime like that. And he had discovered that doorway on March the 21st, actually the day of the spring equinox. And another drawing that she had at the same time showed a kind of pyramid with a snake running down it. And I thought, well, that must be somehow connected with the Mexican pyramids, you know, the one at Chichen Itza, where at the equinox, there's a kind of shadow snake that goes down the side of the balustrade.
An incredible display, that is.
Yeah, I've seen it. It is very amazing. Huh. But anyway, so I thought, well, that actually gives us the date, you know, 21st of March, which is actually when Ganton Brink made the discovery.
Yeah.
So it seemed to me very interesting that she had almost, you know, prophesied the discovery of the door on that day. And there were a couple of other diagrams I tried to interpret as well, but those are the two main ones. So I said to her, well, this is interesting. Can you tell me what's behind the door? So she said, well, I'll try and have a look, see if I can find out for you. And then a few weeks later, she contacted me and said, yes, I've been up there and I've had a look behind the door. And said it gave me a terrible headache going up there. So I imagine it would, going up that narrow shaft.
Did she tell you anything more about how she did this? Because then it sounds like it was a strain on her in that sense to do it.
Yeah. I don't know, some kind of mental travel or something. I don't know. Oh. Remote viewing. But anyway, she came back to me and she had drawn had pictures drawn by an artist to draw them for her properly. And she said there's actually two rooms there. First one kind of got a kind of Anubis figure in there, a sort of guardian figure. And she said there were various things in there. There was a kind of boat and a few other bits and pieces. And she said, you go through a doorway into another chamber, and on the wall there's a kind of half-sculpted figure of a pharaoh with his arms crossed, holding the crook and the flail.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that doesn't seem surprising. And she said, there's a big sarcophagus in there, which is where he's buried. Right. And said, there's two big serpents down the lid, and at either end of the coffin, the tomb, there are about 4 foot high golden eagles, hawks. Yeah.
Right.
One at each end. So I thought, well, don't tell the Egyptians or they'll knock down the pyramid to get the golden hawks. But, no, seriously, she didn't know why there would be golden hawks either end of it. But, you know,
those are not the symbolism, do you?
Well, yes. When I started investigating a bit further, I realized that what they represent are the goddesses Isis and Nephthys, who are very often put at either end of the coffin to protect the pharaoh,
mm-hmm.
and they can be shown as hawks. So, you know, this was very interesting in itself, and I took those images and I actually put them on the internet. I think it's an old Netlink site. It's still floating around, actually. If you Google my name and dig around a bit, you would find that website, and I put that up. That was back in about 1996.
You don't have this on your main website?
No, I don't, but I put them up there. Well, I have done in the past, but I've changed the website since then. They're not on there at the moment.
Right.
I might put them back. Anyway, so then a few years later, I was contacted by a gentleman from America, and he said he'd had a recurring dream where he was taken to the Great Pyramid, and he was shown secret chambers in it. And he was actually an architect, so he's actually a good draftsman. And he had drawn pictures of what he was shown. And again, it was two chambers. In one, there was a kind of, I've left this bit out, the kind of like a wine rack with scrolls in it, that she had seen in the first chamber. Which, that to me is more exciting than anything, because that would have writings. I mean, that is a hall of records, isn't it?
That's right, exactly.
And then this gentleman saw the same thing, and he saw the boat, and he saw the tomb. So, from two sources, and he claimed that actually there's a secret staircase leading to it that goes from behind one of the slab stones inside the king's chamber. So, he said you could remove this particular stone quite easily. And he drew a careful diagram of this. And in there you'd find the staircase leading up into that chamber.
Okay.
So I passed this information on to Dr. Joseph Shaw and asked him to pass it to the Egyptian authorities to see if they could do something about this. Now, I don't know if anybody has, but it seemed to me weird that two different sources had told me the same thing. And I don't think he'd come across the website before that. I don't think he was sort of deliberately having me on. He seemed genuine.
So have you in some way like try to correlate information in regards to looking at diagrams of the pyramid, or a sketch where you can this room would actually fit in that area, or something like that?
There's plenty of room for it.
Mm-hmm.
There's plenty of room.
Mm-hmm.
These pyramids are huge.
They are, of course.
Yeah. The chambers that we know about are really quite small.
So do you believe it? Do you think that this is true?
Oh, I'm sure that there's something up there. I mean, the shaft in the Queen's Chamber leads to something. It's there for a purpose.
Of course.
They're not going to build... I mean, it's a lot of work building that shaft. If you go to Gantenbrink's own website... if you Google his name, Rudolf Gantenbrink, you'll find his website on the Upuwat project, UPUAT, Upuwat project. He actually did a full survey of the pyramids, of that particular pyramid anyway,
mm-hmm.
sort of carefully measuring everything. And he's an engineer, And so you'll find out what you want to know about sort of size of the pyramid and things from there.
Fascinating.
But he shows what engineering work went into actually building those shafts. It wasn't just a simple matter of drilling a hole.
No, it was not.
It caused a lot of difficulty and complication to build it.
Yeah.
So there must be a reason.
But I mean, we've heard now these stories that we today cannot possibly even begin to try to reconstruct the pyramids. So how do they build them? Do you have any idea?
Well, this clairvoyant, claimed that they're built by aliens. I don't know if that's true.
What do you think? What do you believe?
It's possible. I mean, I don't know how else it was built. Let's put it that way.
Right. Okay.
I mean, it's not just those pyramids themselves. You look at the outside blocks of the pyramids and you say, well, yeah, heave-ho, off we go. We can push them up a ramp and build a pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
But when you go inside, you find that they're great, huge blocks of granite, which weighed 40 tons. You know?
Mm.
And how do you haul up a 40-ton block and position that exactly correctly on top of a pyramid, you know, it's 100 feet up in the air,
yeah.
And you've only got human muscle to pull it up there? It begins to stretch belief, doesn't it?
It does.
And then when you go and look in the Valley Temple down by the Sphinx, some of the blocks there weigh over 60 tons. You know, vast, great blocks. And you wonder how on earth they manipulate these things. So I don't know. I mean, I have one theory about how you could raise up the smaller blocks, and that's if you want to make something go up, send something else down. So if you had a pulley, if you had a bunch of men climbed up to the right level, they hold a string and then they jump off, and it would pull something else up the other side, like a lift, you know?
Right.
Have an elevator, there's a weight, isn't there? A counterweight.
Sure.
When one goes down, the other goes up. They kind of balance the weight that way.
Hmm.
I could imagine something a bit similar to that as being one method, but nobody really knows. And when they tried to build a replica, I don't know if you ever saw this little video of, I think it was Mark Lerner, was building a 9-foot, 9-meter high pyramid, you know, very boldly showing how they did it. Well, in the end, they had to get a forklift truck to put the top on. They couldn't do it. And that was just 9 meters, you know.
Exactly.
So you begin to wonder, don't you?
It's so, you know, obvious. It stares us in the face. Majority of people today know that they're there. But we cannot just wrap our heads around it. You know, if you really think about it, it's just incredible.
Look at it this way. The Egyptians claimed that their gods came from Orion, right? Osiris. They came, they brought civilization to the earth, right? Mm-hmm. This is what's written in their texts. And then after he died, he was resurrected, and he ascended to heaven. It's a bit like Jesus, really, isn't it?
There you go.
He's murdered, he's resurrected, and then he ascends to heaven. He goes back to Orion. And coincidentally, we find a bunch of pyramids that look like the belt of Orion. We don't know how they were built.
Hmm.
It begins to make you wonder, doesn't it?
Of course.
Even if you're a skeptic, you've got to start wondering, well, the technology involved here looks a bit more than kind of ox cart. It's all level, you know. It's like if you go into Africa and you see, you know, some village there, and you come across a great big colonial mansion, and then you look around, you know, it's all overgrown, and, you know, the garden's all overgrown, and it's falling down a bit. And there's some guys living in a few huts. And you say, well, the ancestors of these guys must have built this colonial mansion.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't figure. If you knew a bit of history, you'd realize that actually this was once a colony, and there were people came there, and they're the ones who built the mansion, not the guys who are living there now.
Yeah.
So you begin to think that when you look at these big monuments like the pyramids, and you begin to think, well, it wasn't these ox cart people who built this, you know. It must have been someone who had more technology at their disposal.
And again, just to emphasize the idea that this isn't the only place on Earth where this pops up. It's all over the world. You see Anakso pyramids in China, Chichen Itza, as you mentioned, are just a handful of the hundreds of megalithic sites around the world, you know.
Or even places like Stonehenge.
Absolutely. England, yep.
Amazing monuments. But, you know, those big pillars that you see at Stonehenge,
yeah.
They're not all the same length, but they are right at the height. The height's right to make a nice level platform to put the horizontal ones on, which means the depth of the hole has to vary.
Right.
Stick that in the chalk.
Yeah.
Now you can imagine that you heave this thing up. Oh, my goodness, it's 6 inches too low. We need to fill the hole up. Pull it out again. Put some more earth in. Try it again. No, it's still a bit too low, or it's too high now. You need to take it. Can you imagine? Is that what they did? It's hard to believe, isn't it?
It is. It is.
How on earth did they manage it?
You know,
it's just weird.
I'm thinking also, Adrian, here of, again, if we go back to Egypt for a while, the Stargate theory, if we think about it in the context of the sci-fi story, the Stargate theory is that, you know, they came here from another place, whatever it might be. It might be Orion, might be, you know, from another galaxy even, and set up civilization here, set up shop, as it were, as you mentioned. Yeah. does this have anything to do with the Stargate theory that you were mentioning briefly in the first segment?
I'm glad you mentioned Stargate, because Stargate SG-1 is one of my all-time favorite series.
Oh, really? There you go.
Yeah. I absolutely love it.
I love the first film that did it. Yeah, it's incredible.
When that film came out, I went to see it, and it was just around the time the Orion mystery was launched.
There you go.
And I thought, my God, you know, they got hold of our manuscripts.
Who'd have done, yeah.
One of the first things that happened was that Daniel, I think his name is, who's the Egyptologist, a bit geeky, and he's kind of translating the hieroglyphs for them. And the clue to him is Orion. He realizes that these glyphs represent different star groups. That gives you the address. You know, it's like a big telephone, isn't it?
Yeah.
You dial up the address and you can zoom up to the stars. Well, yeah. I mean, I think that film in many respects was kind of prophetic of the situation that we're in. The idea that there are other civilizations elsewhere, and maybe they're human-like. I mean, this is the other weird thing, isn't it? And this is actually comes back to what J.J. Hertak was saying, that the pattern that we're built to, the pattern of Adam and Eve, comes from the stars.
Mm.
Now, that is I suppose it's a very controversial theory. You know, do we come from apes or do we come from the stars?
Mm.
But there's something about us. And you have to wonder about evolution. Again, I'm a skeptic on the idea that evolution is just blind chance. I can't believe it, that every little thing in your body is so clever. You know, every little tiny thing that works, and there are all sorts of little tiny glands that do this or that, or cells which are specialized to do some particular thing that affects some other part of the body, to think that that has all just evolved out of the mud, just of itself, for no reason. Yeah?
Yeah.
It's like lifting yourself up by your own shoelaces. You know, you can't do it. It just doesn't work.
And
you know?
And they've shown how protein, is being assembled almost by these tiny machine-like things, and it's like the chicken or the egg. You know, what came first? You know, for a function of this to exist inside the body, this must have been there to begin with. You know, it doesn't work out.
That's right.
It doesn't work.
Well, it's working against the laws of physics, which are everything runs down. You've heard of the word entropy.
Yeah.
Everything tends towards disorder in the world, doesn't it? A steam engine is not as efficient as the energy of the coal it burns. There's some energy is lost.
Yeah.
And constantly, each time energy processes go on, each time energy is transformed, brings more disorder. So you have the idea of the universe as a clock that's running down. Mm. And your body ought to be, with all those complicated molecules, burning in this oxygen-rich atmosphere and turning into something less complicated. But it doesn't, you know. You see a baby and the baby grows. It becomes an adult. It matures, it develops. And I remember a scientist saying to me, a lecture I was at a long time ago, and I was at university, and he said, how do you unscramble an egg? Right? You know, scrambled eggs.
Mm.
Right? So how do you unscramble an egg? And you think about that. How do you unscramble an egg? The reason you can't unscramble it, of course, is connected with the ideas of entropy and irreversibility. And there's only one way to unscramble an egg, and that's to feed it to a chicken.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's what you mean.
It's the only way to unscramble an egg. Life has a power to bring about order.
Hmm.
When you have something like a chicken, which is filled with life, it can reorder the energy that's contained in that egg, that scrambled egg, and produce a new egg, a higher order thing than the scrambled egg, you know, that has the potential to become a chicken itself.
Yes.
So you can begin to understand that there are other forces, other processes involved in this universe than the simple material energies that we deal with in science, you know, in physics and chemistry and so forth. There are life energies. There are energies of mind and consciousness. There are energies of creativity. And these kind of form a whole scale of energies. Have you ever heard of a guy called Robert Flood? lived in the 17th century.
Definitely heard the name many, many times. Yeah.
Right. He was living in the early part of the 17th century, just before actually the time of the Invisible College. And he wrote a number of books going into all of these subjects and actually laying out the concept of ladders of energy reaching up to God and scales of music. If you've heard of Gurdjieff, a lot of Gurdjieff's ideas, I'm quite sure, come from Flood.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But anyway, so this idea that there are scales and levels of energies is what's the missing part of what we're taught in science today. And once you begin to understand that, I mean, you know and I know that the car you drive today has evolved from the kind of Ford Darrock of 1904, the cars that you see in those old films. You can say, yeah, well, my car's evolved from that. But you know very well, and I know very well, that it didn't just happen. A lot of intelligence and thought over the decades has gone into taking that car and moving it forward. It's the same with computers.
Yeah. The
first computer I had, had two floppy disk drives and a tiny memory of, a few K, and you couldn't do very much with it.
Yeah.
Computer I've got on my desk now is probably more powerful enough to send an Apollo spacecraft to the moon. Mm. I mean, when I was working in Sweden in 1981, the guys there, I was a computer programmer at the time, and the guys there very proudly showed me the pride and joy of their computer room, which was they had a brand new disk drive, which held a whole gigabyte of data.
Oh, my.
Right?
Yeah.
And it was the size of a washing machine.
An incredible machine, yeah. There you go.
I've got a little, one of those little memory chips you stick in, which holds 8 gigabytes.
Yeah, yeah.
A thing which is only about 2 inches long.
Yeah.
This is evolution.
Progress. And
it's progress, but it happens because people are intelligent and they use their minds, address those problems, and they move things forward. It doesn't happen because the washing machine side disk drive bumped into another washing machine disk drive and said, actually, we could do this better if we, accidentally, change the configuration of the chip.
Right, right.
It doesn't work that way. Nothing happens by accident.
Of course not.
It's
obvious when you think about it, really. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what you're saying here, I guess, so you're using the computer as an analogy for what is happening with the human species and other species on this planet, how we're evolving, and also that it is a conscious force, right, that is behind how this
right.
progress is taking place. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. Now, thank you for that, because think of this. The first computer I had, desktop computer, right, was great. I could do my word processing on it.
Mm.
Then I got a more powerful computer. I could do some graphic stuff with that. And then I got a few more programs. I could do my accounts and a few other things. But the big, big change came when, in I think it was 1995, 96, I first plugged it in to the World Wide Web. And suddenly I can send emails. Suddenly I can access websites elsewhere. Suddenly my computer, which till then had been a kind of self-contained unit, became part of this network.
Awareness, consciousness came into the picture.
Yeah, and it could access all of this knowledge all over the planet, and just have to Google in any word, and you can pick up links to websites that you didn't even know existed anywhere. Hmm. Suddenly this thing becomes not just a toy, and not just a sort of little personal thing for doing sort of writing letters or whatever. It becomes a channel into the whole of human knowledge. Now, I see this as an analogy to us. We've got a computer in our heads, our brain. And, you're educated at school. You learn stuff. You put it in.
You program your brain, right?
You program your brain.
Yeah.
And you learn by experience and so forth. And you maybe become a bit creative and you do some stuff and you write stuff and so forth. But what if your brain could click into something the equivalent of the internet And this is what the ancient Gnostics were all about. When you read the Hermetica, which I republished, this is the ancient book supposedly written by Hermes Trismegistus. Mm. It's actually a group of a set of lectures and essays from probably around the time of Jesus, maybe a little after, that were from Alexandria, a school in Alexandria. And it begins with his own initiation, the initiation of Hermes. Mm. When he meets a being who calls himself Poimandres, which means shepherd of men, and identifies himself as being the higher mind and the logos, right?
Yeah.
And he initiates him, he shows him how the universe works, he shows him about the fall of man and what's possible, etc. This is a very, very important book. It was a big inspiration for people at the time of the Renaissance, and also people like Robert Flood wrote a lot about this. But imagine if, as human beings, we could switch on that part of our brain which connected us with the higher mind.
Yeah.
Then we would become aware again of the greater purpose of the universe. Instead of it being just us here in this planet doing our own thing out of sync with nature, we would know what the plan is for the whole of nature and for ourselves and for the universe and everything else. We would know the mind of God. Yeah, put it in other words, in religious terms.
Interesting.
And that, to me, is what all mysticism is really about, is about reconnecting to the overmind, the big mind. Yeah?
Yeah.
Big G, tetragrammaton, whatever you want to call it. Seeing what he has to say about the subject. This is why you get the whole idea of Jesus, for example, and he's saying, not my way, thy way. I put my own will aside, you know. Never mind what I, as little ego, want. What's the big picture? You know, what's it that you want? Big God, big I. And that, I believe, is going to be the major step that the human race is going to have to face in the next generation, or maybe even sooner, maybe even the next few years, is this transition from this kind of fragmented societies that we live in, where everybody's ambitions are different from everyone else's, where everyone's trying to pull a quick one over on everyone else, where the politicians are corrupt, the bankers are robbing, you know,
yeah.
And there's too many of us anyway to feed. You know, the sheer injustice of our situation to connecting to the higher intelligence, that which actually put us here in the first place, because I don't believe we came here by chance. I think that that's a naive attitude that modern science has developed, to think that we're here by chance or that life just evolves by chance. To me, that's just naive. They think I'm naive for believing in God,
right.
But I think they're naive for not believing in God.
Well, there you go. Yeah, exactly. And you're talking about this in the terms of, you know, very near in the future. Is this an event then that might take place, or is it a realization in various individuals that slowly initiates, if you will, or begins this process of reconnecting with the archetypal image of what God is? Or what do you think it is?
Yeah. Right. Well, let me put the time context in first of all.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a book in the year 2000, well, that's when it was published, called Signs in the Sky. And that was basically an exploration of biblical prophecy in the light of modern-day astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
But also linked in with Egypt and the pyramids and what they were telling us about the same kind of thing. And I interpreted the start of the last book, the Book of Revelation, or the Apocalypse of St. John, whatever you like to call it. The beginning of that book talks about how St. John has a vision of this great cosmic being who identifies himself. He says, I'm the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last. And he describes this being as wearing a belt and shining like the sun in its strength and holding seven stars in his hands. I don't know if you've ever read that, It's in the first couple of chapters of the book of Revelation.
I must have read it.
Yeah. And I sort of had this intuition that this symbol was actually meant to represent Orion. That the Alpha and the Omega, Orion is the gatekeeper. Orion, if you look at the a picture of the solar, not of the sky, using a sky globe program or some such, you will see this clearly, that there's the band of the Milky Way runs up through the sky, and Orion is on one side of it. But he's holding a hand or a club, however you like to vision it, up towards the ecliptic, which is the pathway of the sun. You know, the sun moves along the ecliptic 1 degree each day, roughly speaking.
Right.
So it makes a complete circuit in 365 days. And just over that hand of Orion is where the ecliptic pathway of the sun crosses over the equator, or the median plane of the Milky Way. Right? So that is a crossroads in the sky. And the ancient people believed that there's two places in the sky where the ecliptic crosses over the Milky Way. One is in the northern hemisphere, as I say, it's over the hand of Orion. It's actually the border between the constellations of Gemini and Taurus.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm.
The other one is in the southern sky, in Sagittarius, over the sting of Scorpio.
Yeah.
And that's close to the center of the galaxy, as John Major Jenkins was telling me.
Indeed, yeah.
These two positions in the sky, the ancients regarded as being gateways. I call them stargates, because I like the term. But they're stargates. And they believe that souls come in through one and go out through the other. And after you die, that walk along the Milky Way, way of the dead, and get reborn coming in through the other one. That's one set of beliefs. But more importantly than that, these stargates actually mark out time very precisely, much more precisely than the concept of ages being linked to signs of the zodiac. As you probably realize, that the signs of the zodiac are different lengths. So some signs are large, like Pisces, for instance, is quite large. Aries is quite small. Some are medium sized, like Leo. Libra is very small. So if you're going to say that you're going to start different ages by when the sun, through its precession in the equinox, moves through different signs, you're going to have very uneven ages. But if you have a marker point which is more exact, then you can divide up your zodiac into equal segments.
Right. Yes,
don't necessarily exactly correspond with the zodiacal signs, the constellations, but you can divide up evenly and accurately. And the stargates give you that, the exact positions where the ecliptic crosses over the median plane of the Milky Way. And it now happens that the sun is positioned with those points. It's over the hand of Orion, exactly at the stargate, at the time of the summer solstice, on the 21st. And I took a party of people to Egypt to witness this on June the 21st, because it just happens that at Giza, the sun would also be at exactly the right height above the horizon on that day, that if you were standing at the west side of the Khafre pyramid, at the foot of it, you could look up the pyramid and you would see the sun sit directly on top. And the pyramid cast no shadow as it crossed the east-west axis.
Yeah. Incredible. Yeah.
So that was a kind of sign. And so you can imagine, you couldn't see Orion, but you can imagine that as that's happening, he's stretched out in the sky with his hand reaching out to the sun. Right? And I see the sun as symbolizing an ankh. Key of life.
So this is what you're describing. This is taking place behind the veil of the blue sky, as it were, right?
Yeah, you can't see because of the brightness of the sun. You can't see stars, unfortunately. Maybe you could in space if you had some kind of special telescope that could block out the sunlight. But anyway, we can imagine this because we have computers. We can figure it. that the sun is like a key, Ankh, being placed in the gate, the stargate.
Mm.
Yeah? So if you imagine that Orion symbolizes first and the last, this gateway moves down and it moves up over the course of thousands of years. So 13,000 years ago, that stargate, that Orion stargate, was at its lowest position, and the sun would be there at the winter solstice. And then in the course of the last 13,000 years, it's been moving steadily north, and it's now in its most northern position, right?
Yeah.
So the sun is there at that stargate in the Omega position. So Alpha and Omega, the first and last, he measures out time. He's the Time Lord, yeah?
Yeah.
And the belt of Orion now is just positioned below the celestial equator. Imagine our planet's equator projected into the sky. It gives you the equator of the celestial sphere, the sphere that the stars kind of fit on and rotate round us. So that's how we see it. Now that belt will never actually cross that line before it starts moving down again. But in the biblical prophecies of Jesus in Matthew 24, when he's standing on the Mount of Olives, he talks about as lightning goes from the east to the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man.
Mm-hmm.
You maybe heard those words.
Yeah.
Well, that word lightning is, in Greek, it's astrope. And it's the same root, astra, which means a light. And I think it's been a mistranslation. It should be asterays, as the stars go from the east to the west.
Right,
and
right.
The stars are the belt of Orion, which now rises in the east over the Mount of Olives, right?
Mm-hmm.
Goes over, you know, and sets in the west, exactly in the west.
Do you think the Mount of Olives is an analogy for the pyramid in that sentence?
Well, Mount of Olives is to the east of Jerusalem, and it's where Jesus sat and gave various sermons, and it's where he's ascended to heaven.
Right, but you don't think that's a veiled term for that they're actually speaking about the pyramid in Egypt or something like that?
There is a little pyramid at the foot of it.
Okay.
A little kind of temple with a carved pyramid on top of it.
Oh.
It just happened that on June the 29th, that's a week after the Egypt, the sun on the pyramid, and we went on to Israel to witness this, or as much as we could, that Orion would be rising over the Mount of Olives. And it would have positioned on one side of him, you would have the sun, the moon, Mars, and Venus. Sorry, no, not the moon, Mercury. On the other side, you would have the moon, Jupiter, and Saturn. So he's actually standing amidst the seven planets, which in the ancients were seven lights
or seven stars.
And symbolized by seven stars, in the book of Revelation. So that has not happened before since Jesus wrote those or said those words, right?
Ah.
So, and the next chapter after this starts, lo, a door in heaven is open. So I'd sort of interpret this as meaning that this is the opening of the Stargate and the start of the book of Revelation.
Mm-hmm.
And within a few weeks of our coming back home from there, the intifada broke out between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and there were people firing guns from positions where we had been watching the stars just a few weeks earlier, watching the beginning of this rising of Orion. We saw the moon and Jupiter and Saturn. We couldn't see the rest because once the sun comes up to a certain height, it blots out everything else. But we saw the beginning of it. And Orion would be standing there with his feet on the Mount of Olives. This goes much further than this because also in Signs in the Sky, and I wrote something about this in my book Magi as well, you can understand that the stories about Jesus, a lot of those relate also to the stars.
Yes.
I'm not going to go into this in detail, but I worked out the actual dates when various things happened, like the crucifixion and the resurrection and the ascension and so forth.
Based upon using one of these sky programs where you can actually align the sky? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. You had to work out sort of when things began.
Yes.
That he had a 3-year mission, and it began in 26 AD. And you can work that out from, I think it's St. Luke's Gospel, which talks about the building of Herod's temple, and said it had been going for 20 years. I worked this out, so that was actually the year. 3 years later puts you in 29 AD, and we know that the crucifixion is supposed to have happened at the first full moon after the equinox, mm-hmm. which is when Passover festival will be held. And that gave me a date. I think it's the 14th of April. Anyway, it's all in my book. But I've discovered, to my amazement, I mean, there's a lot of correlations involved in the crucifixion and the resurrection, but to my amazement, I discovered the ascension took place when the sun's positioned exactly at the Stargate over the hand of Orion.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, you know, I'm going to the right hand of the Father.
Mm.
And there the sun is at the right hand of Orion. It's just weird, you know. So, and now we have a situation where that position is positioned exactly at the summer solstice. So whatever has been prophesied as the end of time or the end of days, end of whatever, it must be our time, because this isn't going to last for for a long period of time.
When approximately did we enter into this area and our time, and when does it approximately end then? Are we talking about a time span here or a small frame?
Yeah, it's talking about a time span of, for 1 degree, the precession of the equinox takes
years.
About 72 years. So
yeah.
I think if we talk around about 1970 to, I know, 2030,
so this
that's
is
all period.
So this
you know?
Is the shifting of the ages, as it were, moving from Piscean age into the Aquarian age, then, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. In my opinion, I mean, I don't think you should be looking at the constellation of Pisces and Aquarius to see where that cutoff is. If you look at the Stargate, you can work out, you know, the 30 degrees. We're now, if you worked out when the summer solstice occurs,
mm.
then you can work out when the equinox will occur. Yeah.
Mm.
And what should be the appropriate tropical sign for that? And it is now moving into Aquarius. So
this is the opening of the Stargate again, and the story. The story is becoming, it's tying back on itself again, in a way.
Absolutely, and fortunately, we had a camera team with us who filmed all this when we were in South Africa. They're from South Africa, and we're in Egypt and Israel.
Mm.
And the film they made is actually going to be broadcast by EMTV next week.
Oh, really? Okay.
It's the first time ever in England. It's been broadcast in South Africa, but it's never been broadcast over here. So on Thursday next week, they're going to broadcast it's called Signs in the Sky. It's going out at 8 o'clock on EMTV.
Mm.
And then after that, I'm going to be interviewed by one of their guys. For an hour afterwards to talk about that. So if anyone's listening from England or who has access to EMTV in Europe, I don't know if you do you? Sky Channel 100.
I've talked a little bit with Keith Goodyear, and he has mentioned that we probably should have access even up here in Sweden to it, but I'm not sure about all the mechanics, but they do have all that available on the Edge Media TV website, I think, where people can find that out. Very interesting.
Yeah. But we're also going to be selling DVDs of the program as well. So if anyone can't watch it on Sky, they will be able to get hold of a DVD if they'd like to see it.
That's excellent. But, and you know, will you have that available on your website when that's available?
Hopefully, yes. Hopefully.
Good. Do you know how long it's going to be?
Well, I've got to set up a shop.
Yes.
That. There's a lot of tech. You know what it's like with websites.
I know, it's a hassle.
But every bit of creativity you do, there's a lot of other donkey work that nobody sees.
Going on in the background, yeah.
Going on in the background. And
absolutely.
So doing all of that, it's hard work. But
yes.
I'm onto it.
Mm-hmm. Well, excellent. That sounds absolutely fascinating. So again, Signs in the Sky is the title. And
yeah.
Is this a one-hour program or 2 hours?
It's a one-hour program. Mm-hmm. And, of course, there's also the book, Signs in the Sky, which has been republished by our friends, the ARE, the Edgar Cayce people.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they republished it in America.
Are you involved with them otherwise in other cases? Or?
I've given a number of lectures there, and they've been very keen to publish some of my books, so that's been really good.
Interesting, okay.
They've also done my last book, which is over here. It's called The End of Time, but they call it 2012, My Year of Destiny.
with a bit more punch in the title there, I guess.
More American, isn't it?
Well, exactly. There you go. That's good. Yeah. Wow. So really incredible stuff. And the science in the sky and this coming Thursday, you mentioned, definitely going to look out for that. And I'm very interested in getting a copy later on of the DVD. I definitely want to see it. Is it more of a, what should we call it, a documentary style in that sense, or is it more of a lecture?
It's a documentary. I was basically taking this group of people, there were 18 of us all together, and we went to Egypt. We were going. See, I predicted that this would happen about the sun sitting on the pyramid, and I believe that this is very symbolic, and it was needed that someone should go and witness this, you know, and not just let it happen and just ignore it. And the second half of that being in Jerusalem and recognizing the importance of this Orion amidst the seven planets over the Mount of Olives, that someone should be there consciously recognizing it. I mean, it might sound a bit weird, but on behalf of the human race, you know, not to let it just happen, nobody's there, nobody took any notice.
Do you think that this could contribute to the fact that this particular place then is important, or can this be seen from any other location or at any other place in time?
Well, yes, you would see the rising of Orion in the east. And one of the interesting things about this is that the little star Mintaka, the top one of the belt, which, as I say, is positioned just about on the equator, just a few minutes of degree below, you will be able to see that virtually everywhere in the world, from the North Pole to the South Pole.
Yeah.
Okay. Because being on the equator, you know, if you're too far south, you can't see the northern stars. If you're too far north, you can't see the southern stars. If you're on the equator, everyone sees it. So I see this as being kind of like a cosmic symbol of a timing for us. Look for when that star rises in the east and sets in the west. Yeah, because that's the time. Now, I was half expecting to see Jesus skipping down the skipping down the Mount of Olives. It didn't happen.
It didn't.
It would have been nice. Would have been nice, you know, sort of this being sort of emerges out of a cloud, you know, holes in his hands, and says, "Oh, I'm back."
Oh my God! It didn't. Because it's a symbolic story, right? In that
it's
sense,
a symbolic story. Yeah. But maybe something is going to. I mean, maybe, you know. I don't know exactly how to interpret this, whether we are supposed to expect him as a person to say, right, I'm back and I'm going to sort it, or whether we're talking about the birth of a new consciousness, a Christ consciousness that's going to come upon us all. There's different ways you can look at this, but I kind of see the 2012 event, which we're all talking about now, of course, with the Mayan prophecy and so on, as the kind of the other side of the coin. So it's like the opening of the southern stargate. So we've opened the northern one. We've yet to open the southern one, which will happen in 2012. So maybe something really big is going to happen then. I don't know. Maybe I'm going to look stupid with egg on my face. But I think we ought to be prepared that something might well happen. And we should be open to this possibility and not be skeptical and say, well, this is just nonsense. This is just, you know, just a cosmic movement of planets and sun, and doesn't matter, doesn't mean anything, nothing means anything. If we take that attitude, then we're going to be in the wrong space, in my opinion. We need to start thinking that life matters, humans matter, the world matters, the universe matters. Yeah, something made it, something very clever made it, and it behoves us, it's be sensible for us to try to understand what that clever you know, the problem we have with God is that we tend to think of him as being like Santa Claus, you know, this old man with a white beard, you know, reaching out a finger to touch the finger of Adam, you know, in the Sistine Chapel. Yeah. We have too much of an anthropomorphic vision. We need to start seeing that there's this creative power in the universe and the creative power in the solar system, creative power in the world and in ourselves, all on different scales. And how can we align ourselves with that and to you know, attaining the possibilities which it requires and wants? How can we find our role in this?
Adrian, in the best case, so to speak, that you could imagine, what would you wish for taking place at this particular time?
Right. Well, I do believe there's going to be a kind of waking up. I mean, this is what is prophesied, is the angels blow their trumpets, you know, and the dead come out of their graves. Well, I don't see it quite as physical as that, you know. I remember arguing with my father about this. He was sort of very devout Roman Catholic, and he believed, you know, the resurrection of the dead. And I said, well, you know, what about those molecules that are going to make up, you know, this dead body? They might have belonged to someone else in the previous century, you know. Mm. Who's going to have them? I don't see it that way. The way that you're resurrected is like the chicken eating the egg. In other words, you're reborn. Reincarnation. There's more people alive today than have ever been. There's more people in the body now than have ever been.
Mm.
If you like. If you believe in reincarnation, and I do, it's the only sensible way, it's the only just way I can deal with the idea of the inequalities we see in the world, is to say that we're born into different situations for different experiences, and that we have different lives to experience different things. That makes sense to me. But if the angel blows his trumpet and the people wake up, something switches on in their head. They remember who they are. We're all asleep. You know, we're like zombies sleepwalking on this planet. You know, we think we're awake. We think we're doing good stuff. But most of the time, we're completely asleep.
Yep.
We're asleep to our higher possibilities. So if we woke up, we might sort of stand up and say, what the heck? You know, what have I been doing? You know, it'd be like a sleepwalker, and he wakes up and he suddenly discovers he's standing in the middle of a busy street. And he could easily be run over. And he's sort of, wow, how the hell did I get here? I'm wearing my pajamas, you know, and I'm standing in this busy street.
Yeah,
we might feel like that.
Well, in some sense, I recognize the image that you're describing, because I certainly don't claim that I'm fully awake in that sense. I know that there is always things that you can work on as an individual, and certain things that you need to refine on a personal level and all that stuff. But with that having said that, I think that the initial kind of wake-up process happened for me a couple of years back. And
right.
And that was an experience like that in many cases. Like, what the heck have I been doing all this time, in a way, you know? It's something else going on here. There's much more happening, and the awareness is totally different from, you know, one point until, or if you compared with previously. So do you think that will happen on a mass scale then, I guess?
I think it will, yes. And, I mean, I've had a few sort of strange experiences, but one that I've talked about particularly happened to me back in, it was about 1971, long time ago now. And I was a student at the time, and I'd been practicing yoga for about a year. And I was in a very tense emotional state, because I was split with a girlfriend and I was feeling very upset about it. So there was a certain amount of emotional energy churning around. And I went to the seaside, which is not a few miles away from university, with a couple of friends. We drove out there, and it was dark. It was nighttime. I sat on the beach, and I was sort of meditating, passing sand through my hands, and I suddenly had this overwhelming experience of the oneness of everything, you know, that the sand, the sea, my hands, me, the stars, my friends, the moon, everything was all one being. It was, you know, you read about this, and when I say these words, it sounds very trite and artificial and stupid. But when you have this kind of different state of consciousness, realization, it jolts you, and it makes you think, my God, you know, what else? You know, the rest of my life is pointless. This was just so amazing that I'm one with, you know, you read about Upanishads about the Atman and the Brahman. The spark in the individual is just part of the spark of the whole. And I was experiencing it, and I'd only been doing yoga for a year. You're not supposed to have that sort of experience for 40 years, you know. I couldn't believe it. And that started me on my path, really, of trying to understand what this was all about. So I can see what you're saying. You've had something similar that jolted you.
Absolutely, and this comes in you know, in different waves and in different fields as well, really. Because again, I think that what you're describing here is the kind of initial the spiritual awareness of self-awakening, as it were. And yes. That's, I think, it's the first step towards anything. And many people have that for various reasons. Some might be looking into the the conspiracies of the world and have the same, a similar type of awakening, and that, oh shit, you know, there's they have another type of awareness to it. But what you're describing, I guess, is the more spiritual level to this, and absolutely fascinating.
Well, you know, on that occasion, and you know, even more on a later occasion, I actually had what I would describe as a small sip from the Holy Grail. I feel like, you know, the guy, you know, the guys go out searching for the Holy Grail, this cup of immortality that, you know, King Arthur had lost, or if it appeared, and then they have to go and find it. And I feel like one of those knights who's been searching, and he finds it, but he doesn't say the right words at the right time. He's supposed to say, you know, who do you serve? He forgets to say that, so he has a little sip, and then it disappears again. I feel like that, you know. I'm just hoping that maybe part of this thing will be getting back to that and having another good drink out of it.
Well, it's the carrot that keeps you going and helping other people to, you know, get to the same place. And with your, you know, discoveries, as it were, and your contribution to this field, I think you're encouraging other people to look into the similar areas. And again, everything from, you know, ancient history, the mysteries of the ancient world, are all subjects, I feel, that helped to bring people into another mindset, if you will, almost, that opens them up in another way. You know, it's like something incredible has been going on here in the past. Yeah. Is it still happening, you know, in that sense? Are we part of it all who are here? And I think it's wonderful that you're doing it, you know, again, because it's ultimately about enriching, in that sense, other people's experiences here as well, and laying the puzzle of world history and try to figure out what has been going on and what is happening currently, you know?
Well, I would put another word to it as well, and that word is duty. Mm-hmm. It's not a word we hear very much these days, but people helped me in the past, you know, people who've now passed on, and they give me good advice and they've shown me things and helped me. And now I feel it's the turn of people in my generation. I should be 60 this year. And we have to work to pass on the torch to the next generation. You understand that?
Yeah.
People my age, because we've been given things, we've been shown things. It becomes our duty to help others the way we've been helped. So that's another reason why I've set up this website. And it's really part of this whole process of passing on to the next generation. Because there's another side to that as well, and that is that in order to move forwards yourself, and Gurdjieff wrote about this, in order to move up to the next step, you've got to put someone else in the step that you were on previously.
Mm, yeah.
That's part of the teachings of the way. I suppose it's a bit like climbing a mountain, isn't it? You want to go up the mountain, you're roped together with all these people. And so the whole team has to move up. Otherwise, nobody can move. So kind
exactly.
of it. I want to get to the position where I can move on to the next stage, but I can't do that just on my own. I've got to help other people, and that's my duty.
It's a very
and then it becomes
point,
the duty of other people to help those who are behind them.
Yeah.
And it might be then,
again, you were talking about taking a sip, as it were, from using the analogy of the Holy Grail, but so maybe what you're describing or talking about is a in your... With your theory that we are potentially approaching this connectivity with the mind of God, or that this the mind of God is in some way even created as we all kind of connect, I guess, on a spiritual level as well, and we cannot perhaps maybe do it only as individuals, but we have to be more people along in that journey, so to speak, because again we don't really know what the functions are of the brain and what the purpose is for the human race collectively, and this might be one of them. Yeah. You know, we don't know that.
Well, also, if you're not prepared for this, then it could be extremely frightening.
Of course,
you know?
Yeah.
So the task of people like myself, and perhaps yourself, and the work that you're doing, is to awaken people to the possibility so that if it happens, they can then say, oh, yeah, they warned me that this might happen.
Right.
That's what's going on, yeah?
A preparation a little bit for it.
yeah, I don't need to flip out. I don't need to kill myself. I don't need to do something stupid. No, I've been warned that this might happen.
Yeah,
I can go with this, and let's see where it takes me. That's kind of another part of it.
Exactly. It's like before you feel a big wave coming on, it's a certain sensation in that. It's drawing to, you know, okay, you know, you can almost feel the tension in the air, as it were. And
yeah,
yeah, that's very, very interesting. And I think, Adrian, that actually is a good pointer to begin to round things up here for
yeah.
this time. And I've enjoyed very much having you on the program, and I think it's going to be a really interesting meeting you, of course, down in London, but also watching a lecture and just seeing some more of your material, as it were. To begin to round things up here, please go ahead and mention your websites again, and also mention a few of your book titles for people who are interested in getting copies of your material.
My books you can buy off my website, which is www.adriangilbert.co.uk. Right, so that's my own personal website, and then you can see details about all of the books that I've written. There's 8 books: The Orion Mystery, Cosmic Wisdom. Let's see what else we got. Mayan Prophecies, that's out of print. Magi, The Holy Kingdom, I think that's out of print as well. The New Jerusalem is going to be republished very shortly. And The End of Time and Signs in the Sky. So you'll be able to read all about my books there. Meanwhile, I've also just set up and just gone live about a week ago, The Invisible College. And the address for that is www.theinvisiblecollege.net. And if you go there, you'll find details about how you can join. There's a little video on the front page of myself telling you about it. There's a few things you can click and have a look at first, make up your mind. And if you want to join us, be very, very welcome. And it only costs £10 a year, which is less than 20p a week, or 30 American cents. So worth doing, and you'll find, I hope, new friends, and be part of this growing movement that we're pioneering and pushing forwards. Be part of it and help us do it.
Absolutely fascinating. And the websites are theinvisiblecollege.net and adriangilbert.co.uk. Check out the articles there as well. There's some very interesting writing up there. And then, of course, for the conference that Adrian and others will be attending, avii.co.uk. For more information on that. Thank you very much for joining us, Adrian. There's just so much more to talk about, and we'd love to have you back on the show sometime as well and talk a little more about some of the hermetic astrology that you're writing about and other subjects as well, of course.
Yeah, we'll do that, Henrik. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much as well.
That's our program with Adrian Gilbert. We'll be back on Sunday with more fascinating radio, all for your consideration, that we hope will add to your perspective and open your eyes to new fields and areas of discovery. Upcoming on the show, we have Scott Tips, part 2 of our webcast with Michael Tesserio, and further ahead we have Tony Goslin, who's behind the Bilderberg.org website, and Helen Sewell on astrology and current times. My thanks to Fredrik Palmgren behind the controls, and to you for being with us. Take good care, and we'll see you soon. Bye-bye.